Good morning and welcome to Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. We're your hosts, Aisha Khalif and Rain Lolas. Our goal is to spark curiosity, provide valuable insights, and shed light on important issues within the legal world. This week's show focuses on the reevaluation of tort claims in family law. We'll be exploring how the legal system addresses family violence, including intimate partner violence, and whether current torts are sufficient to capture the unique harms experienced by survivors.
Before we start the show, we would like to say that the views expressed on the show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, hosts, or the Queen's University Faculty of Law. This podcast does not contain any legal advice. Pro Bono Students Canada is a student organization. This podcast was prepared with the assistance of PBSC Queen's Law Student Volunteers. PBSC students are not lawyers. They are not authorized to provide legal advice. In this episode, we take a high-level look at tort claims in family law. This is not legal advice. Only a lawyer can help you decide if a specific legal argument applies to your situation. In Ontario, family violence, and more specifically, intimate partner violence, has been on the rise. In December of 2023, around 100-plus organizations wrote an open letter to Premier Ford urging him to declare intimate partner violence a provincial epidemic. With shelters overwhelmed, turning away nearly 700 women and 236 children each night, vulnerable groups such as women, individuals with disabilities, newcomers, and Indigenous peoples are disproportionately affected. While police reported cases of IPV have risen, they remain vastly underreported, and limited data exists on how family violence is addressed in courts. Today, we will examine the potential of tort law to serve as a deterrent against family violence. We will be considering this in the context of the Ontario Superior Court's decision in Aluwalia versus Aluwalia, a 2022 case which recognized family violence as a new tort, and the Ontario Court of Appeal's subsequent decision to reverse this decision. For reference, a tort is a civil wrong where one party's actions or omissions cause harm or loss to another, leading to a legal liability. The primary aim of tort law is to provide compensation to victims for their injuries or damages resulting from another's wrongdoing. The legal landscape evolves to address new challenges and societal changes. When courts recognize a new tort, they also acknowledge a previously unaddressed type of wrongful conduct as actionable, allowing victims to seek remedies under this new category. In Aluwalia, Mrs. Aluwalia sued her husband, Mr. Aluwalia, for damages related to a pattern of emotional, physical, and financial abuse experienced throughout their marriage. Mrs. Aluwalia argued that existing torts like assault and battery did not adequately capture the harm of this ongoing coercive control. The trial judge recognized a new tort of family violence to compensate her for the abuse, finding that this new tort would make the courts more accessible to survivors of intimate partner violence. As a result, Mrs. Aluwalia was awarded $150,000 in damages. On appeal, the Ontario Court of Appeal overturned this decision, rejecting the new tort and reducing her damages to $100,000. The court found that the new tort may be weaponized and held that existing torts could be applied to address the situation. The case has been referred to the Supreme Court of Canada and is currently in progress. Our guest today has extensively researched and advocated for the recognition of coercive control as a distinct tort that covers the harm that the family violence tort aimed to deter, but opens its use up to other relationships. This discussion aims to shed light on whether the legal system can more effectively address the complex realities of family violence.
Joining us today is Professor Mary Jo Maurer, who teaches courses in tort law, family law, and dispute resolution. Her research focuses on improving the family law procedural system to better serve all parties in a family law dispute. Before joining Queen's Law full-time, she practiced family law in Kingston for over 25 years. A two-time recipient of the Law Student Society Teaching Excellence Award, Professor Maurer is known for her innovative teaching methods. She played a key role in creating and delivering Queen's Law's Certificate in Law program, a pioneering online and blended program for undergraduate students. Some of her recent publications include two issues for the Canadian Family Law Quarterly, with one issue discussing the Ontario Court of Appeal's decision in Aluwalia. Professor Maurer, thank you so much for joining us today. Start us off, it would be helpful to understand the foundation we're working with. Could you briefly run us through the current torts that have been or could be used in family violence cases?
Sure. Why don't I back you up a little bit and talk about what is a tort briefly? So we're talking about intentional torts here. So this is not negligence. We're talking about times when a person intentionally hurts another. So the kinds of cases that we have where this comes up is battery. So for example, and I'm going to use the gendered terms because we know statistically that it's usually a man abusing a woman. There are rare cases where the shoe was on the other foot, but they're not common. So if a man abuses a woman and he hits her, for example, she can sue him for battery. She could sue him for the tort of intentional infliction of mental suffering. So that's, as you guys know from class, that's a really important tort that talks about mental injury. And you get money just for the injury. I mean, that's really important. Women can sue for assault. The tort of assault, of course, is threatening. So as we frequently, this gets messed up between criminal law and tort law. In tort law, civil law, not criminal court, we're talking about threats. We're talking about someone who threatens another. If you want to talk about someone touching another without consent, that's battery. So those are the main torts that we have right now. We might be able to come up with other intentional torts. Sometimes there's financial torts like fraud, or deceit, where money's been stolen. But the main ones that turn up in abusive situations are battery, assault, and intentional infliction of mental suffering.
Thank you. So, in the recent case, Aluwalia versus Aluwalia, the trial judge introduced the new tort of family violence, agreeing with the plaintiff that existing torts don't fully capture the coercion and control at the core of many abusive relationships. How do you feel about this new tort? Do you agree that this new tort is necessary for this purpose?
I agree we need a new tort. So I like Justice Mandani's idea that the current situation of using those older torts of assault, battery, and intentional infliction of mental suffering does not capture the full flavor of what happens. But I don't think she quite nailed it. With greatest respect to her, she's a wonderful judge and she was trying to do something big and important, and she did. She brought this to everyone's attention. So, personally, I think a family violence tort based on the Divorce Act would not be right because the Divorce Act was never meant to create a tort. The Divorce Act is meant to help judges figure out what factors to apply to parenting cases. So, if you take that definition of family violence that's now in the new Divorce Act and you turn it into a tort, you've skipped a whole bunch of steps in order to create a properly founded intentional tort in a common law system. So I just said a whole bunch of challenging things in there. If there's anything you want me to explain, let me know.
Could you explain what the Divorce Act entails? What does it, yeah.
So the Divorce Act was amended in 2021. I think that's when it got final assent. And it's massively changed, which is good. We needed these changes. The old act just said a judge should think about what's in a child's best interest and award custody or access accordingly. And this was unsatisfactory because if you think about it, and I'm sure your audience is going to tell you the same thing, what does that even mean? So I walk into court as a mother. I mean, I had four kids. I've got some anecdotal experience there. What I think is best for the children might be different from what a judge thinks. So it was quite subjective. What the judge thought would prevail. Now, there were some, I'm not saying it was all subjective. There were obviously some norms that had been developed over the years about what was important and what was not. But the act needed some more structure for judges about how to manage these parenting cases. So the new act contains a definition of family violence. Judges are told you must take family violence into account. So the way it reads is taking into account any family violence, including a pattern of coercive controlling behavior. So this introduces a whole new idea. What is coercive controlling behavior? So just so everybody knows, those provisions in the Divorce Act were imported into the provincial legislation as well. So even if you're not married, these provisions will apply to unmarried cohabitants using the Children's Law Reform Act. So the same, almost word for word, the provincial government imported them. I have to tell you this, I was happily surprised to see that, thrilled to see it. I think a lot of the provinces did the same thing. So this was a good thing. It meant it reduced the distinction between married and unmarried cohabitants.
Can I ask a follow-up question? What
Yeah.
caused for that distinction or that new caveat to be added to the Divorce Act? What was the reason? Did someone champion that change for family violence to be included in, for the consideration?
Many, many groups championed that change. So, that definition, let's talk about the Divorce Act since it's the federal act and applies nationally. That definition that we have now is the only written statutory definition we have of family violence. So, it includes a whole bunch of wonderful things that are family violence, financial abuse, abusing pets, killing pets. Psychological abuse. It includes a lot of the things that abused women know are part of family violence. So, this knowledge was never repeated in the statute. It was hard to come by in judicial decisions. Some judges are more attuned to this kind of stuff than others. So, it was nice to see that there was now a definition that we could use for determining parenting issues that told us, okay, we have to take family violence into account. What is family violence and how do we define it? So that's extremely helpful. But then, can we turn that definition into a tort? That's what Justice Mandani tried to do. She tried to say, okay, we've got this wonderful definition. It's the only definition we have of family violence. Can we not say all of these same things can create the tort of family violence? So your audience might wonder, well, what's the difference between a tort and a criminal charge?
In her note in the California Law Review issue, Sarah Garrett defined coercive control as any pattern of behavior that isolates, dominates, controls, or deprives the survivor of basic rights and liberty. Garrett recommends against criminalizing coercive control behavior as it would cause backlash against survivors and would affect marginalized communities disproportionately. Do you agree with this conclusion? And in what ways would you think approaching coercive control in civil law would be different than approaching it in criminal law?
What a great question. Well researched, well done. Okay, so what she's saying there is we should not criminalize coercive control. So that means, should we turn it into something that results in a criminal penalty? My research is all about, should we turn it into something that's a civil penalty where the abuser pays money? I, as you know from class, I think money is a great remedy. I'm happy with money. Money is good. So anyway, she's saying we have to be cautious about turning it into a criminal offense because it could have repercussions for survivors. A civil penalty would also have repercussions for survivors. So the problem with turning it into a criminal offense is that it's hard to define. It's easier to define it in civil court on balance of probabilities than it is to define it in crim court beyond a reasonable doubt. We're talking about family dynamics here and determining what happened beyond a reasonable doubt in criminal court is going to be difficult in a family situation. There's often a lot of back and forth. So even in a coercive controlling relationship, the abuser is going to be able to stand up and say, well, she retaliated and she hit me back. Now, what's a criminal court judge going to do with that? So I think criminalizing it is not impossible. And Canada is considering this. There was a private member's bill that got all the way through the House. I think it made it through the Senate, and then it is just sitting there doing nothing at the moment. I don't know if it's ever going to receive royal assent. And this bill would have criminalized that behavior. Some countries in the world have done this. For example, the UK has criminalized coercive control, so they've made it a crime. The other problem with it is the police. How do the police do this? Knock on your door. Okay, did you were you mean to the pets? Did you psychologically abuse your spouse? So police jobs are normally pretty simple. Did you batter your spouse? Did you touch your spouse? Did you make threatening words? And do we have evidence of that? So that's the kind of simpler police work that we want them to do. It's much harder for them to make these kind of nuanced findings. Is there enough here to support a charge of this potential criminal offense of coercive control? So there's a lot of work to be done in that area.
Thank you, Professor. In your article, the Ontario Court of Appeals decision in Ahluwalia versus Ahluwalia, Prudence or Opportunity Missed, you argue that the development of new torts should be deliberate and gradual. Do you think that the trial court in Ahluwalia moved too quickly in recognizing a new tort? If so, what risks do you see in that approach?
Okay, I don't think it moved too quickly because both the Court of Appeal and the trial judge noted correctly that this is an epidemic in Canada. Like, the statistics are astounding. You can't turn around and have a conversation with a woman without her telling you of an incident of abuse. You know, when you get to be my age, you've suffered many, right? It's kind of tapered off now that I'm old, but this is something that is shockingly common. So did she move too quickly? I would say rather she did not move correctly, if that makes sense. So she tried to repurpose something, the Divorce Act definition, into something it was not, which is a tort. So is there room to do this? There is indeed, but it needs to be done based on how intentional torts have been built in the past. So remember that we have a common law system. So in Ontario and all the other provinces except Quebec, we have this system where we build new law on the back of old law. So as each judge makes a decision, we build a new idea and a new idea. I think we're in a position to build this tort of coercive control, but that's not what she called it. She called it the tort of family violence. So, when you're ready, there's a challenge there in restricting a tort just to family law. If you want me to expand on that, I can, or I can take your questions, whatever you prefer.
No, I think we would love if you would expand on that, actually.
I'm excited about this topic, as you know. So, here's the thing. If you restrict that intentional tort just to family law, you're missing out on a whole bunch of other areas where it occurs. Coercive control doesn't just occur between couples in a conjugal relationship, it also occurs in elder abuse cases. So, if we restricted it to the Family Law Act, the Children's Law Reform Act, the Divorce Act, we would be missing out that whole piece where it's possible for a child, for example, to abuse their parent and to control their parent. So think of all the cases you may have heard of where the parent gets bullied. Basically, coercive control is bullying, if you want to use a common word, gets bullied into giving their child money, for example, or into selling the house, or into doing things that are not in their interests because they're older, they may feel frail, they may not be able to defend themselves as well as their child can. So that's one of the reasons. The other reason that I think there's a challenge in creating a family law specific tort is it creates family law as an exceptional area of the law. Family law is not exceptional. All the same rules apply in family law as apply in every other area of law. Some people disagree with me, but I think that's the right way to go. For example, the law of contracts. The law of contracts exists in family law with all the same rules as it does in other situations, like business situations. There are some minor statutory tweaks there about disclosure in family law that might be different, but overall, the basic law is the same. So, creating this family law specific tort could shut out a lot of people who could use that remedy. And then you might have some smart aleck who creates the tort of coercive control, but not for family law settings. So, now you've got these two torts competing with each other. So I think we should create one tort, a tort of coercive control. We know enough about coercive control now to be able to identify it and use it in family law, use it in elder abuse cases. There are business situations where one business partner is being bullied by another, where you could use that tort, right? So that's why, if that makes any sense.
That does. Thank you. Following up on the recognition of coercive control, we know that coercive control includes behaviors like forced confessions, interrogations, and lockdowns, which go beyond physical abuse. How do these tactics differ from assault as what we un traditionally understand in tort law?
Oh, yeah. Like you could say, false imprisonment. There's another tort that sometimes turns up in family law situations where someone's confined to a room and can't get out. Okay. So let's take false imprisonment as an example. That tort can still exist. The tort of coercive control would not wipe out all these other torts. In fact, it would carry on alongside them. So let's imagine, and I had a case like this. It was kind of heartbreaking, where this woman was confined to her room by her husband for days at a time. He would let her out to go to the bathroom and then put her right back in the room, shove food in there. And she was in there for a very long time and wouldn't let her see the children. So that's false imprisonment, right? He has no legal authority to put her in that room and keep her there. However, she would get damages just for the imprisonment. Okay, so she'd win. And the court would say, you get damages for being falsely imprisoned. But she would not get any damage for her loss of autonomy. So the thing about coercive control is it's a big idea. The idea is that this person is controlling you. They've taken away your autonomy. They've taken away your ability to make decisions. And there are some indicators of this loss of autonomy, like social isolation, physical isolation, stealing all the money or refusing to allow her access to the money, physical abuse to control her into behaving. Some of the abuses I've seen include clothing. She's not allowed to buy her own clothes. He buys them and tells her what to wear. And, says she's only allowed to go to this church. She's not allowed to access her physician. She's not allowed to access a mental health counselor. She's not allowed to go to her own church. She's not allowed to see her family. So coercive control is characterized by this slow washing away of autonomy. And that is a completely separate thing from getting damages for intentional infliction of mental suffering. This loss of autonomy, you guys know this from taking torts. Torts protects autonomy, if nothing else. So I think it makes sense to have a tort that protects autonomy and that awards damages for the failure to protect it and for any incursions into it. So does that make sense? Did I probably went off wollygagging. Did I answer the question?
You did. That was great. Thank you.
We actually had a follow-up question about the appeal level decision. So at the appeal level in Ahluwalia, Justice Binodo concluded that creating a new tort wasn't necessary. Instead, she suggested that aggravated damages could be increased where there's evidence of repeated coercion, control, or breach of trust. If the evidence of coercive control is distinct enough to justify higher damages, why do you think it wouldn't also justify like a creation of a new tort?
I think it does justify the creation of a new tort. And I disagree with Justice Bonato on this, as you can tell from my piece. I think those other torts compensate for different damages. Intentional infliction of mental suffering compensates for ongoing mental health issues. So what she said is, well, if you've been coercively controlled, you will inevitably suffer ongoing mental health issues. So she kind of through the course of control in with the idea of intentional infliction of mental suffering. But I disagree. I knew women whose autonomy was invaded severely, but they didn't suffer any long-term mental health issues because they were resilient. So are we going to say to a resilient woman, you get nothing, even though you were controlled in this relationship? Oh, yeah, good for you. You're resilient. It doesn't take away from the fact that she was isolated. She had no money. She was physically restrained in some cases, forced to do things that were outside her comfort zone in bed, that kind of thing. That just goes uncompensated, goes right out the window, unless she can prove she suffered mental damage. So it may be that in cases of coercive control, there is some resulting mental damage. That makes sense. But it's not always there, and it's a different damage, right? The loss of your autonomy is fundamental in our society. We're all allowed to do what we choose to do within the limits of the law, and no one should be able to take that away from you. Does that kind of answer
No,
it?
that's great. Thank you. One of the goals of tort law is deterrence. Given that family violence is often underreported, do you think that a new tort like family violence could be an effective deterrent?
A new tort like coercive control could, yes, for sure. The one thing that people hate more than anything else is paying money to their ex. I shouldn't laugh about it, but it's true. One of the things that Justice Bonato said that I disagreed with a lot was that we should sort out the family property issues first and then see what torts are around and see what money's left. That's not how civil damages work. No civil judge who's hearing a tort claim is going to ask, oh, do they have any money to pay it? They might in a conference, but at the trial, they don't care. They write the judgment, and it's up to the plaintiff to enforce it or not. I think the same thing should be true. Is it her concern was that it could badly affect the children because now this one parent is really in the hole? He dug it. That's why he's in the hole. So this doesn't mean he can't see the children if he meets the right criteria for seeing the children. But I think it's a separate head of damage and it's an important one. So, yes, I do think it would have deterrent value. I think if the word got out that if you abuse your spouse by controlling her, it could cost you money, that might deter it. A lot of abusers think, well, I never hit her. I never strangled her. I never pulled her hair. I never beat her. I never did any of the things. I mean, it would horrify you to know just what me and my little old family practice came across in terms of abuse, but some of it was pretty bad. I didn't do any of those things. But I did restrict her socially, restrict her sexually, disallowed her access to money. I disallowed her access to her faith of choice, to her physician, to a mental health professional. That's enough. Right? That's enough. So I think a lot of people who commit this abuse think they're going to get away with it, rightly, as long as they didn't hit her or threaten to hurt her or stick her in a room and lock the door. You know, those are the kinds of things that tend to result in damages now. So I think we need a tort that addresses this loss of autonomy and this invasion of autonomy. So, and I think the definition you gave earlier, Rain, was correct, that it's about the loss of autonomy. So that's, does everyone agree with me? No. Many people think it would just be easier to have this tort of family violence, and we should just uphold the trial decision in the Ahluwalia case. I think that would be lazy. I think that would not hit the mark, and it would be a waste of a perfectly great tort that we could use in other situations. So,
Thank you, Professor Maurer. Throughout torts, we learned about different existing torts, such as battery. Battery is one that also seeks to protect an individual's right to personal autonomy. Could you go a little bit into describing the difference of protecting an individual's autonomy through coercive control versus battery?
That's a wonderful question. Thank you for that, Rain. Well, think of it this way. We are all surrounded by a bubble, and you've heard my bubble talk in class. We have, imagine a chalk outline around all of us that no one should invade. So, for example, if you give consent, a doctor can invade your bubble. That's battery. Battery says, do you have consent to touch this person? That's an invasion of your corporeal self, of your physical self. But what do we do when the invasion is of your right to make decisions? So I think of coercive control as an analogous invasion. So instead of it being an invasion of your physical bubble, it's an invasion of your autonomy, of your mental bubble, your right to make decisions for yourself. Your right to determine where you're going in life and how you're dressing and how you present yourself to the world. This is very challenging for people in more traditional relationships. Very challenging, because often the woman doesn't see herself as having that right anymore. She gave up her name, she left her family. So, in more traditional situations and thinking, she may think she doesn't have those rights, but in our society, she does. So that's how I see it, as being a similar idea, but a different kind of invasion, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I really appreciate the comparison of like the physical with the mental. Thinking beyond Ahluwalia and all of that we discussed today, what do you see as the future role of tort law in addressing family violence in general? Are there other areas of law or policy that you believe need to evolve alongside this to help facilitate the broader goal of protecting women and people who are vulnerable in these relationships?
Well, we need broader education about this, obviously. We keep saying that, and everybody keeps going, oh yeah, it's an epidemic, but not in my household. You know, so they don't see it for the broad epidemic and the hidden and shameful epidemic that it is. So I think we need education about how it's not something to be ashamed of, that it happens to high-functioning professional women. It's not just happening to women with no education or from another culture or things like that. It's a universal kind of thing. I think tort law could cover it quite nicely. I don't think we need much else. I think we just need to note that it is an invasion of someone's will, of their voluntariness, to take that away from them. So I think tort law could cover it, but I do think people need to understand. When I teach family law, it's always embarrassing for the men in the class, because I say, guys, I hate to say this, but it's mostly you. And I try not to offend, but it is mostly men. So we need to educate our little boys. We need to teach them that that's not on. You have to ask for permission for that. You have to, behave in a way that respects women's autonomy, and including talking to your mother.
Professor Maurer, thank you so much for joining us today to discuss our topic on reimagining justice and the potential need for a new tort in family law. It has been incredibly insightful to hear your perspective on this important issue. Once again, we deeply appreciate you being part of Queen's Law Pro Bono Radio. And to all of our listeners, thank you for tuning in. We hope you found today's discussion as engaging and thought-provoking as we did.